copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to be with you. I will tell you at the beginning, this is the first time I have ever done this presentation. And so I'm interested to hear what I'm going to say as much as you are. And it's a fascinating subject to me for a number of reasons. Now, one of those is that in ministry, sometimes we find great leaders and sometimes we find poor leaders. And my experience of when I went to theological school in preparation to become a pastor was that I assumed I would be prepared and know everything to do in the pastorate and be highly successful. And I discovered that I received a lot of information that was very helpful. But in terms of knowing how to lead an organization, I learned very little to minimal when I was in a theological school. And I discovered to my sorrow that a number of the friends I made during those years in theological school did very poorly after they graduated, and they were unable to make it successfully as pastors. They had the desire, they had a theological training, but they didn't really understand how to function as leaders in ministry in the pastoral role they had. And I always thought that it was a shame, and that was a terrible failing of a school not to consider that. Otherwise, you're giving 3 years of preparation, and you waste a lot of the money and time when a person can't function effectively. Recently, I was involved in some other research that had to do with a major issue and the role of pastors in addressing that. And as we looked at the combined results of all the research, one of the things we discovered is that 80% of the people who were pastors were not leaders. They saw themselves as teachers. They saw themselves as counselors. They saw themselves as those who could help and heal and do various things, but they did not really consider themselves to be leaders. And then I look back on my own experience, and I realize that many of the things that made the biggest difference in my life were experiences I had before engaging in ministry. Some of those were work. I grew up in a small town, and at an early age, I had to work. My father had a doctor for a father who was very prominent, highly successful. But when my father was in the eighth grade, he said, "Son, you will have a bed and you will have your food. If you want anything else, earn it." And he said, "If it was good enough for me, it's good enough for you. And from now on, you'll have a bed and you'll have your food, but if you want anything, you have to earn it." And I look back and I think my father did me a favor in helping me understand what work was and the benefit of it. So I worked on a farm, and it was not unusual in the summers to get up at 4:30 to work hard all day in the field, and then to be involved in sports in the evening. You know, you're at that age with a lot of energy. As I got older, I did some other things. I became very involved in sports, and think that a lot of what I learned about working with people, about teams, about leading, came from the experience I had in sports. For 3 years, I was a butcher when I was in high school. And you know what a butcher does. So I've told people that was very good preparation for ministry. It's amazing what you can learn with all these different experiences. And there were quite a few more, but I don't need to elaborate on those. What I want to say is that it seems to me we need to be a little more self-conscious and serious about what it takes to become a leader and giving people, young people and others, the kind of experiences they need in order to learn this and develop leadership skills so that they can become effective as they get older. Now, what I'm going to do is try to reflect on this in a way that may be helpful to you. And I often work better if we're talking. So if you have a question about something, don't hesitate to stop and ask me. And it may actually improve what we're accomplishing. So feel free to ask a question as we go along. I think you always look at leadership as beginning early, not when you get your first job. And that's why I told you about some of my own personal experience, because that made a huge difference. But you can also ask what a person's background was as far as their family. We know statistically that if you're raised in a stable home, two parents, it's a healthy household, you're much more likely to develop the traits that lead to good leadership. Statistically, less good leaders come from single-parent homes. And if it's a homeless environment, you can imagine how much more challenging it would be. There are things you learn in a home, watching your parents, responding to them as you grow up. It's like you learn a language. These are things that are very important in terms of functioning, and it helps tremendously. Another thing that you ask is, well, what was your educational experience? What type of education did you have, and how did that benefit you? I grew up in the United States where, for the most part, everything is monocultural, at least when I was growing up. Now it's less so. And people in many parts of the country were not accustomed to hearing another language or encountering a different culture. And so if they ever did, they were much older and it was more difficult to acquire. Now, think of that in terms of development as a leader. So if you don't have any of these experiences when you're young, the older you get, the harder it is to be flexible and acquire the skills and understanding that you need in order to function well. You don't have to go to a wonderful school. As a matter of fact, only about a third of the top leaders go to top schools. Most go to just average schools. The education is important. Being in an elite school does not necessarily make a difference except in one way. Do you have any idea what that is? It's the social part. What contributes to social capital? The people you meet, and some of those people who may rise to great success can be helpful to you later, but it's also the social skills. It's knowing how to dress, how to talk, how to behave. There are some people who come from backgrounds where they're unprepared for an unusual opportunity. And so they don't know how to dress. And when they come into a situation, they don't handle themselves well enough to make a favorable impression and get the job. You don't think about it because it just never has occurred to you until you find yourself in a different environment and then you're uncomfortable. And you don't know exactly what you should do next or how to express yourself. So the more you have those experiences early, the more that can help you. The other thing that fits into this is what leadership roles you may have in your younger years. The younger you have leadership experiences, the more valuable it becomes to you in later life and in all the opportunities that come your way. God has been very good to me in my life, so I've had quite a few opportunities in the world of ministry and even beyond that. And as I look back, I realize a good bit of that occurred when I was in school. So I would be given an opportunity, maybe in student government, maybe in sports. And if you're given that kind of opportunity, you become a little more accustomed to it, and you expect to take advantage of the next opportunity that comes your way. And it's only natural that it should work out this way. Then I've talked about what kind of schools you attend, the difference that can make. I've had friends who showed all kinds of unusual ability when they were in school. One friend of mine, when he was in college, developed a business of selling flowers. You know how there's special events at college, and everyone is supposed to have flowers and all that. So on those occasions, he became very prepared. He started out small, but when he finished, he would have 8 telephones in his room. He would handle thousands of flowers. He made so much money doing that, he could pay for all his education and have thousands of dollars left over. Now, that's entrepreneurial leadership. There are very few people who did that sort of thing, but there were those who saw other opportunities and took advantage of it. When I was in college, there was a period of time when my wife and I were married before I graduated. And it was a little difficult to have the money we needed. So I could take a job and work and make so much money an hour. One of the things I discovered is that if I could get a little better job, I made more money per hour. So I became the assistant resident manager for 200 apartments. But then I discovered there were other things. People needed to eat. And one of the things that's good for everybody is eggs. And I happened to know where there were chicken farms, poultry farms. And so I arranged to go and visit the farms, and I talked to the men who owned the chicken farms, and I said, could I buy the cracked eggs you have in large quantity? And so they would sell them to me for a given price. Well, I would buy these huge crates of eggs and have to make a couple of trips. But I'd buy 12 to 14 crates of eggs. And then I would go around to all the student apartments and everywhere else and sell those eggs. I can make 3 times as much money an hour selling eggs as I could any other job by the hour. And so I found, oh man, this is a great opportunity. Well, I look back and I realize there are all these different experiences you have. And you may think, well, I'm just trying to find a way to live and eke out an existence. But you're really learning skills that will make a difference. And they're going to determine the kind of person you are. How much you think and analyze situations, how creative you can be, how entrepreneurial you might be. And all of these things will enable you to do better or less well in given work situations. Another thing that you ask yourself is, well, what about my faith? Because there's no way to be involved in ministry without a strong faith. Very strong faith that doesn't waver, and a faith that's well grounded. you want that. One of the questions you can ask yourself is, when did you become a Christian? And was your family Christian? Lots of people who end up in leadership come from Christian homes where they were nurtured, they were educated, they learned what it was like to be involved in a Christian world, in church, in all kinds of endeavors that were for Christians and so on. I came from a very different background. My family was very non-Christian. Before I ever went to the first grade, I knew how to play every kind of poker there was. I knew how to mix any kind of alcoholic drink there was. When I was just learning to talk, my grandfather taught me how to use profane language. We say cuss, you know. So he would tell me a word, and he would have me stomp my foot and say it. And if I did that very well, I got a dollar. If I didn't do it well, I caught grief. Now, I was getting an education. Quite an education. But it was not an education that fit for Christian ministry like I'm doing today. Although, see, I can say this. Because I grew up in a very non-Christian environment, and I experienced all those things. And then because I went to education in very non-Christian environments, I now understand that world better than many Christians. I can be very comfortable around people like that and know how to talk to them and work with them. So you say, it's not all bad, it's how you use it. On the other hand, my wife grew up in a very strong Christian home. And she was just the opposite. And it's made a huge difference as we blend those two backgrounds and see them come into some fruitful expression. So all these things make a difference. For those of us who were converted a little later, sometimes that change was so powerful and dramatic that we will never forget the difference it has made. And the way it deepens our commitment and helps us understand how we cannot be a part of the dark side of life. All of these things factor in. And if we're thinking of the leaders we want to be, it isn't enough just to say, you know how to plan, you know how to communicate. It's much more holistic than that. It's the kind of person you are. And you ask yourself, did becoming a Christian affect other relationships? Probably. In my case, it did. And some of those were for the better. Relationships were enhanced. For some of them, it was made a little more difficult. And some people weren't sure what you really meant by becoming a Christian. And the only way they would be able to tell is how you began to live differently in the commitments you made. And living in that environment and that network of relationships and watching how people responded positively and negatively would make a huge difference. My parents, for example, thought it was okay that I became a Christian. It was not a problem until I became serious and started talking about ministry. And then they said, that is really bad. Now, if you want to do that, we can't stop you. But don't you try to influence your brothers and sister. And here you're in a home where you encounter this kind of thing. And all of this makes a huge difference in shaping you into the kind of person you're going to be. How do you handle these things? Because ultimately a leader has to handle not only praise, but criticism, adversity, hardship. And if you can't manage those and come out the other side, you will never be a really good leader. How did that shape your vocational calling? One of the things that happens to people who are converted when they're older is they immediately wonder if they shouldn't go into some kind of specifically Christian ministry. If they shouldn't become a missionary or pastor or do something like that. Work for Crew, work for Scripture Union, a different kind of ministry. And it's a natural thing because the person has such a change of mind and heart. They want to give themselves to the Lord. That's only right. It's often far later, and sometimes too late, that people begin to understand every vocation can be ministry. It's not a matter of now that I'm converted, I have to do specifically Christian ministry. It's understanding that now that I'm converted, whatever God has made me for vocationally, I can serve Him in this work. And my task is to learn how I can serve God in the work He has made me to do. Some of you saw Chariots of Fire. So, you know, it was about this very thing. Eric Little, and when he ran well, he glorified God. There are others who, when they work for a bank, or if they are selling, or if they're making furniture, they're doing what God has gifted them to do, and they're serving Him. Martin Luther said, sometimes the person who makes shoes is serving God more effectively than the pastor of the church. It will work on shaping that. It also should make a difference in your sense of responsibility. And I'll return to this later. But when you become a Christian, and as you are beginning to be shaped into a leader, there is a sense of responsibility or accountability. I've got to answer to God for my life, not just other people, but God, for how I use my life. And I don't want to waste it. I want it to count. It also should make all the difference in the world in shaping your character. If you are a believer, then you are called to good works. You are called to live a life that is good through and through, a virtuous life. As you think about character, I think it's fair to say that it really is a statement of who you are. What kind of person are you? And if it's a statement of who you are, what kind of person you are, it becomes the basis of trust. And if I had to say there's any one thing that's most important in being a leader, it's this. People have to trust you. If they can't trust you, they will never follow you. Now, there are other things involved in credibility and trust. You've got to have a good performance record. But essentially, it begins with character. In all management surveys of leaders of corporations and the like, you know the number one criterion is character. Some would say honesty. Really, they're saying character. And for a Christian, you would say easily the most important thing should be character. The kind of people God is making us to be. That's always been the great strength of the church. And if it's a great strength of the church, God turns us into a different kind of people. Then it should be even more so for those who are the leaders that this would be the case. You would ask yourself then questions that answer where you are in terms of character, honesty, integrity, and the like. So you say, how does your own life compare to God's expectation of you? Where do you find yourself deficient? Where do you find yourself conforming more to the kind of good life that God calls you to live? A life that fits His commandments, a life that fits the moral standards of the Scriptures. Along with this, you might think of this item at the bottom, and that is, do you keep your promises? Because that's a good sign of character. You say you're going to do something, do you do it? There was a person I really respected, and a number of times he disappointed me in saying he was going to do something, and it was important, and then he didn't do it. I later learned when he said, I'm going to do something, he was thinking about doing something. He didn't really mean he was going to do something. But until I learned to interpret his statements, I had a big problem. So you have to think about that. If you say you're going to do something, you set out to do it, do you keep your promise? What is the pattern of your work experience? We talked about what you did prior to college, your reputation as a worker, that is your work ethic. Because at a younger age, you really develop a work ethic. Are you willing to work harder to succeed and to have an opportunity to advance? That's a big question to ask. A lot of people are not willing to work extra or work hard. Some years ago, there was a joke about a person who went to interview for a job, and he asked the person who was interviewing, he said, do the raises come automatically, or do I have to work for them? Which is not the best question to ask, you know? So, typically, you have to be willing to do whatever needs to be done. You have to demonstrate character. You have to demonstrate that you're willing to work as hard or harder than anyone, sacrifice as much as anyone, in order to make things work for you to have the opportunity to be a leader. People expect that. If you're not willing to set the example in that, how can you expect others to follow you? You have to be prepared to do that. All really good leaders end up paying a price. And we'll come back to this later. But I'll give you one example in terms of my own life and work. I was head of theological school that was growing and doing very well. But it became apparent in order to capitalize on opportunities, it was going to demand a lot of work. My last 12 years, I was gone 3 weeks every month plus weekends. Now my children were grown, they weren't at home. But I was gone 3 weeks every month, home only 1 week a month, and in the office that week. 12 to 16 hour days typically. Not many people are willing to do that. Not for an extended period of time. Now, eventually, I was tired. You know, it happens, you get tired. And so I got to a point where I just could not do it anymore. But if we were going to build a school and take advantage of the opportunities, someone had to pay the price. And I had to be the person. There was no one else who could do all of that. Now, I loved it. It was great. I was never complaining. But I tell you There is always a price to be paid, and you've got to know if you're willing to do it. Working those long hours, making the sacrifices as needed. And part of what enables you to do that is you love what you do. I mean, what's more wonderful than serving the Lord? And if you love the ministry to which God has called you, and you see it as an opportunity to serve people, change lives, see all kinds of good things happen, doesn't that motivate you tremendously? And those who aren't willing to work hard because they love the ministry so much will never reap the reward that's possible. And there's some that only see it as a stepping stone. So they do this in order to get to the next thing, which is the worst possible decision you can make. You should take a job, and particularly a leadership job, because you believe in this ministry. And you want to see this ministry blessed and advanced, and you're willing to put yourself heart and soul into it and sacrifice as necessary to make it happen. Now, when you're willing to do that, other people will see it. They'll see the good results and they'll be willing to follow you. I think with it, you learn to love the people that you work with. Some of them may make it a bit of a challenge to love them, but, you know, that can happen. But the more closely you work with them, the more you see their strengths and their commitments, and the more you help them develop, the more attached you become to them, like family. When I worked at this theological school, I got to know every single person who taught. That was about 55 full-time faculty, all their families. I got to know almost everyone on the staff on 10 different campuses, as well as all the students, lots of them, not everybody. And getting to know those people, getting to know about them personally, created a relationship that made all the difference in the world. Those friendships continue. A few of them have died. Some of them are near the time when they're going to go to be with the Lord. But the relationships remain. And they are powerful. When you start, you don't see that. You see the work. You see the goal. But later, you learn to value the relationships and the significance of those and the strength they bring to what you're doing. Now, if you really care about the people you work with, then you're going to help them feel important and appreciated. And a good leader will do that. A good leader is not interested in being appreciated and praised. He's interested in having the people who work with him appreciated and praised. The more the attention is on them, the better the leadership. So how loyal are you to the organization and to your people, and how does it show? Along with your formal education, if you're involved in ministry, you have to ask yourself, what about your knowledge of the Bible, and theology, Christian history, and things like that that make a difference? Because you really need a good biblical and theological frame of reference. In order to, when you don't have it, it's so easy to fall into some kind of error or another. And throughout the history of the church, it's always been important to have that core understanding of biblical truth and of the tradition of God's people. That won't change. I think beyond that, though, there is so much more that you need to learn. There was a time I didn't really appreciate that as much as I should have. I mean, I was always curious about learning. But if you're going to theological school or even graduate school and then into ministry, you are in a tunnel learning all these things that are required. Then I became a pastor. And so every Sunday there are two sermons, a Bible study in the week, other things that have to be done. And you are constantly doing that. And you don't have time for much else. Your focus is on all those things. Now, as you continue to do this, you learn and grow if you do it right. And so there is a cumulative benefit. And you get to a certain point where lots of these things start coming together and it gets easier. Or, as people say in sports, when you first start, the game is so fast. But when you get good, the game slows down. And it's a lot easier. Then you get to a point in your ministry where much of the core information or knowledge is accumulated, assimilated, and you feel like you can function with this very comfortably. And typically, many people in ministry stop there, and they keep working within the same framework. They may read more books, but the books don't really change them very much. And what you might ask yourself is, how much are you learning about other areas? You may not see how it's pertinent, but the more you learn about other disciplines, all of these different things gradually will provide you a much bigger knowledge context or foundation. And eventually, you'll have a bigger picture with coherence that will enable you to function far better. Now, I work for a man who's been very successful in business. He graduated from college. He borrowed $5,000 from his father. Smart. Then he went into business. He was very careful with his money. He had a tiny office, very small office. His desk was a table where the legs folded, you know. His chair was a folding chair, not near as good as the ones you're sitting in here. And he worked in that setting. If he had to meet people for business, he would rent an automobile for the day. So he had a good automobile to drive them around in, but he didn't have a good car. His wife rode a bicycle. He was very careful to focus his effort on learning the business, getting better at the business, and finding out how to build it. And so he did. He became one of the most successful businessmen in the state of Florida. In 2007, he sold three of his businesses. He had about eight. He sold three for nearly $17 billion. You say, that's not bad. And he still had other businesses. Now, how did he do that? He did that by constantly learning. Lots of people in business don't keep learning. They get one little facet of the business down and they keep doing that and they get good at that. And they're specialized in that. He kept learning more about everything and finding out how all the pieces fit and using that to be smarter than others. And today he is the same. He spends 4 or 5 hours a day reading. Some of it in business and finance. Most of it in other areas. And he is one of the smartest people I've ever known. He never quits learning. As believers, shouldn't we be even more so? The Lord has given us this wonderful world and minds to investigate it and use all of that. So the more we learn to do it, the better. The question is, you have to learn and you want to read. And obviously you broaden your reading. You're really broadening your learning. So how do you learn other than reading? You learn other than reading by talking to people. This particular person I mentioned is very good at asking questions. And so he visits with people, and often I'm with him when he visits. He asks these hard questions, you know? And I think a lot of people are surprised at how well he asks questions. And there are all kinds of ways in which we can do that with other people. There's so many people you can learn from if you're interested enough in what they're doing and you glean from their knowledge and experience. And then, of course, there are the things you learn by working in different areas and by observing. So, you watch things, you listen to news, you talk to other people. There's so many ways in which you gather information and process it, as well as, of course, learning the social skills that we will talk about more later. Is that helpful enough? I think the thing I would say is consider yourself a lifelong learner. Too many people stop learning early in their life. And you've got to say, I need this knowledge as leverage to get a lot more knowledge. With the prior education you have, that becomes a basic foundation on which you begin to build all kinds of other pieces so that eventually you really have a nice palace of learning instead of a little foundation. The reason I say generalist instead of specialist is for this reason. If you are going to be a specialist, you learn a lot about one thing, one area, and you become good at that, maybe better than anyone at doing that. And that is extremely valuable. We need specialists. But if you're going to be a leader, that's different. The specialist becomes somewhat like a technocrat. The generalist becomes a person who is a leader. As someone says, does the leader need to know how many coals there are in the fireplace? And the answer is no. But he needs to know who knows how many coals are in the fireplace. And I'll give you an example about myself. I did all these different jobs. I went to work for a theological school as a member of a faculty. And I enjoyed what I did. But after 3 years of doing it, I decided this is not what I want to do. And so I spent a year investigating other ministry opportunities. And my wife was with me. And I put her through one of the most difficult years we ever had in our marriage. Because I got to the end of that time and I had to sign a contract for another year. Or else no job, you know. So I thought, okay, well, I'll sign a contract for another year. So I did. 3 weeks later, I was asked to become president of the institution. It was an amazing journey that was unexpected to me. I did not set out to become the president of a theological school. What I learned in that year is that I was not a specialist. I didn't know how to say that. If you had asked me at that time, I wouldn't have known exactly what to tell you. I would have only said, I can't spend the rest of my life just doing this. This will drive me nuts if I have to do this for another 10 years. I mean, I can learn so much more, but I can't do this. I've got to do some other things. And so I was learning that I needed to get my fingers into all kinds of other things. As someone would say, you know, I wasn't digging in, I was splattering. And it was true. And had I been more aware of my own background, I would have realized some of those earlier experiences, like selling eggs, were telling me something about the kind of person I was. But I didn't really think about that a lot. My years in the pastorate, I was a generalist. So I could do everything. And it was wonderful. And the churches grew. But when I became a specialist, I found it was too constricting. That's what I mean by the difference in a generalist and a specialist. It's not that you don't know anything. It's that you can know a lot about many things and you know how to fit them together, because that's the real key. A generalist is a person who gets the big picture. Haven't you heard the story of people who are blindfolded and they're able to touch different parts of an elephant and try to figure out what it is? It's only when they see the elephant as a whole they realize what they have. And in a sense, that's what you're doing. And you say, you know, the more I learn, the more information I have about all these things, the more I begin to see how a lot of this fits together. Now, I could tell you that's true about biblical and theological knowledge as well. Just a few years ago, I was talking to one of the five most highly recognized Old Testament scholars in the world. And I said to him his name, and I said, you know, I feel like I'm just learning to understand a lot of this material in the Bible. I thought I understood it before. Now I'm seeing things I've never seen. And he said, you know, there are times I feel that way too. I thought, yeah, I'll bet you do. But it was a reminder to me that no matter what you're doing, there's always so much more that can be learned. And as you reach out into other areas and you begin to integrate these, it becomes highly significant. Then you see how the big plates of life begin to intersect. And it starts to make sense in a way it would never make sense otherwise. And that's what you want for yourself. To get there, you can ask, how good a learner are you? And how do you learn? And are you able to analyze situations and figure them out? I've encountered people who are very analytical. They will talk to people or watch a group, and they'll understand the dynamics and everything that's happening. Other people won't have a clue. And so you ask yourself, am I just getting this kind of superficially, or do I really know the things to look for that make a difference? You see, if a person's working in the financial world, they have to learn to look at the things that make a difference, or else they'll lose some money. And you could say, why should it be any different in the world of ministry? There are all these things we need to learn and learn well. You never stop learning. Keep broadening as you do so that you get the big picture. And with that, you can ask yourself, how well do you learn from your mistakes? You cannot avoid making mistakes, and you shouldn't be afraid to make mistakes. You just try to avoid making really bad ones, the kind that can finish your work. Try to avoid making the bad ones. Know you will make some, be willing to acknowledge them, and learn from them and do better. And those of us who are honest enough to admit where we make mistakes and try to learn and build on that end up doing better. If you're using this in a ministry or organization you're serving, you have to ask yourself, how well do you know this organization? And how does it fit among similar organizations or ministries? And where does it fit in the Christian world? Why is it needed? What difference will it make? If it weren't there, would it really matter? And until you can get some of those answers clearly in your mind, you won't be in a position to contribute as much as you ought. Do you know how your organization will be perceived and needed in the future? Some people just never think about this, but the world is always changing. The Christian faith is still strong in the United States, but the expressions of it are becoming very different. The circumstances that Christians face are changing rapidly. And only those who begin to understand what's happening and make the appropriate adjustments will survive and be strong in the future. I'll give you a secular illustration. I have a friend in Orlando whose family used to own a typewriter company. They sold and repaired typewriters. And the father would never acknowledge the technological change that was coming. He did see electric typewriters, and he moved into that field, but he could not understand how computers would change things. And so ultimately, the company closed, and they were out of business, and he had nothing to replace it. You ask yourself, how do I look at things like this and ask, how could this relate to ministry? Are there ministries that will refuse to learn and make adjustments and therefore they will be out of business in the future? And which ones will learn and be at the cutting edge and most effective in the years to come because they're really good at doing this? You have to know the opportunities. You have to know the challenges, the changing. And I would say always be alert to the trends that are possible, the changes that could affect your ministry. If you're analyzing and planning, I think it's better to be a generalist. I won't say any more about that than what I have. But it will add to it that leaders need to be future-oriented. I told you that the single most important criteria for being a very good leader is character. In the business world, they'll often say honesty, but they mean character and values. The second most important thing is being future-oriented. That is, you may say vision. You may say an understanding of an excitement about what the ministry can accomplish, and you get people to see how this can happen and believe in that, your enthusiasm about that, people willing to work to make it happen. Visionary leadership then becomes second in importance to honesty. And there were ways I learned this. I had become head of a small theological school in a geographical location where it was difficult to be successful for various reasons. And I started analyzing everything, and it occurred to me as I did that in the United States, every major region of the country had one evangelical theological school that became paramount. So I asked our staff, I said, do you think we could become the leading evangelical theological school in this part of the United States? Well, can you imagine how that energized them? Maybe you've heard of Jim Collins, his books, Built to Last, or some management books. In one of the books, he talks about leaders having BHAGs, B-H-A-G, big, hairy, audacious goals. Now, I didn't realize it at the time, but what I had just presented to our staff was the equivalent of a big, hairy, audacious goal. Could we become the dominant evangelical theological school in the southeastern United States? And you talk about people being energized to do something and make a real difference, something significant. Oh, my goodness. But the question is, how are you going to do it? It's one thing to say that. It's another thing to be able to do it. So you have to be able to put a plan together. You have to be able to convince people that plan will work, start implementing it, get a performance record, and then get other people to follow, and eventually it can occur. For us, in time, it did occur. And so we became one of the key theological schools in the U.S. But that was a big part of making it happen. Then we can talk about social skills. I mentioned social capital here. You know, there's intellectual capital, or what you know, the financial capital, or the money, and the social capital, the relationships and all the rest that are important in what you do. It's based on the relationships you have. And you ask yourself, if you're going to be a leader, do you have the ability to build strong, lasting relationships? Can you forge people together into bonds that are strong and tight and difficult to break? Have you ever done a ropes course? Then you know what I mean. Where you learn to depend on the others. And if you don't depend on them, you're going to have big trouble. And here, it's something very similar. You cannot do it by yourself as a leader. You must have the support of others. And you must have the kind of support that is understanding, that is fully committed to what you're doing, and that will stick with it. That's difficult to achieve. There are some people who talk about this in terms of what's called EQ, or relational intelligence. There's an organization that just started in the UK that's built on relational intelligence. In order to have strong relational skills, in addition to caring for people, you have to learn to listen, really listen to people, and know what they think, what's important to them, and how you can help them. I'm convinced that anybody who works with you wants to make a difference. That's why they're in ministry. Why else would they do this? They trust the Lord, and they want what they do to count. What you need to do is help them see how that can help happen. You support them, you praise them, you give their efforts significance. And sometimes they don't see the eternal significance of their efforts. Best leaders are often seen as honest, inspiring, but also competent, forward-looking. So, do you have the ability to build goodwill and trust? And if so, how do you do it? Do you have good oral and written communication skills? You've got to be able to explain things and do it in a persuasive way that makes people want to join in and be a part of it. That means you've got to be able to inspire and excite other people about the work you're doing, to cast a compelling vision. How can you not want to do this and be a part of it? You want to be able to inspire and excite others about the work, and then you want to be able to see how they can work together and how they get the best fit in their work to move the ministry forward. It's not enough for them to want to work and make a difference. It's to get them in the right place where they're really happy with what they're doing and they can see good results and they enjoy working with others to get the task accomplished. Once you see this kind of consistency and good performance, it gives credibility and it encourages others to believe in you and to move everything forward. These are just essential working concepts, but it simply means you're called to serve God and others. That's what ministry is. You are not called to serve yourself. And that's probably one of the most important lessons any leader needs to learn. That is, you are called to servant leadership. And undoubtedly you've heard that before. Your life and your ministry end up becoming a stewardship. It's like the parable of the pounds. You're given a certain amount of resources, a certain amount of time, and you have to produce as much as possible with that. And that means you've got to take your responsibility or stewardship seriously. It is not burying your money in the sand, it's putting it to work and doing as much as you can with it. And stewardship means you can never be happy with the status quo. You want change, you want things to improve, you want it to get better, you're going to move things forward. I've mentioned the necessity of learning from mistakes, and it will happen. The main thing is when it does, learn and don't give up easily. Progress is seldom easy. It may appear that way to outsiders, and many times I've had people tell me things look so easy, and I would think, you just don't know. You really don't understand, but you can't tell them that. Problems or obstacles will face you constantly, and they are merely opportunities in disguise. And that's the way you need to think of it. You've heard necessity is the mother of invention. That's where the whole idea of new paradigm comes from. You can no longer live with certain circumstances. You have to find something else, and it's in that search for something else a whole new paradigm emerges. Remember, everything you do for the Lord counts. The question is, are you willing to do it? Are you willing to pay the price, put your heart into it, and sacrifice? So we stop there. Any other questions? The question is, what about your family? This sounds almost impossible. It can be, and it can do great damage to a family. I think a lot of that is determined by the kind of marriage you have in the first place and the effort you put into building a very strong marriage from the beginning. There have to be a number of understandings and the degree to which that occurs and enables you to work through some other things. Now, when your family is young, there's certain things you have to do that are extremely important in the development of your children and for your family's welfare. And you have to find a way to take care of a lot of that. But typically, you're at an early stage in developing, and the demands aren't nearly as big as they're going to be later. What I always discovered was that if my wife knew how important she was and how much I loved her, and we talked about what I was doing and had some mutual understanding, it worked. If I just knew how much I was doing for her and for the family, and we didn't talk about some of these things, all of a sudden she was wondering, what are you doing, you know? And then you have to come to some understanding. That's simply to say, if you don't communicate and have a shared vision in your marriage, you're laying the groundwork for real trouble. And there are lots of people in ministry who don't take the time to build solidarity in their marriage and in their family so that they talk about what they're doing, how they're going to do it, what's going to be required to make it happen, and so on. And you sacrifice time, you sacrifice money. There were things I had to give up that I would have liked to do, but I could no longer do. And it was okay. My wife made sacrifices. But we all knew what we were trying to accomplish, and we could see how God was using that, and it made it worth it. But there has to be that common understanding and shared commitment in the marriage. If you don't have that early on, and if you don't keep nurturing that. My wife is at this conference. Does that tell you something? And she loves it. Any other questions?
I'm curious to know whether your wife was also a leader in the ministry or not.
Yes, actually my wife was. And when I was a pastor, my wife was very involved. We talked about it. We shared a lot of what we did. She was a real partner in what we did. And so we were doing it together. When I left the pastorate and I became the member of a faculty, the school did not really have a place for wives. And it made it very difficult for my wife because all of a sudden, well, where do I belong? I'm out over here, you know? And she had a tough adjustment. And she worked on that. She found things that made sense and fit. And we talked about it and worked through it. Now, when I became president, she saw a role for herself in preparing the wives of students to be the wives of pastors. And so she immediately started a program to do that. She started a program that was later adopted by 60 other theological schools in the United States. And she did lots of other things too. But, you know, it's a way you share together. And at the beginning, you don't know. We never knew what was going to happen. You take a step at a time. And that's a wonderful adventure of being a Christian. You trust the Lord. You look at the opportunities He gives you. And you do everything you can. And God surprises you. The question is, how do I find my calling? And typically, there are several ways. The first is to understand that whatever vocation you may choose, you can serve the Lord just as much as a person who's a pastor, a missionary, or other Christian ministry. Second is, you say, my calling has to fit my gifts. God has made me to be a certain kind of person, and I can do certain things very well. Now, I could never be a musician. It would be a lost cause. But I've been able to function in ministry very well. And so I know what I can do and I know what I cannot do, and so I follow the things I can do. Now, secondly, there is an internal confirmation by the Holy Spirit. As we do things and we have different experiences, the Holy Spirit enables us to come to some sense that this is a place where I fit. That's never perfect. And I'd be the first to say, I would never write a book on guidance. I think people who want to write books on guidance or asking for trouble and causing a lot of trouble, because it is so hard. My goodness. The other thing is what we call providence. God opens doors and He closes doors. He gives opportunities that let you find yourself and see where you can fit. And as time passes, you begin to see yourself in a different way. I mean, I never felt a call to work at an educational institution. I'll tell you, when I graduated from theological school, I said, I never want to see one of these again. I'm finished. This is it. I wanted to be a pastor or a missionary. So I did that for 10 years. I had four different schools that wanted me to work. And I said, I think God is giving me a message. If four different schools see me as a possibility, I need to explore that. I didn't want to explore that, but I did. And then I thought, well, if it doesn't work, I'll become a pastor again. So it ended up becoming very different. And I could say, well, you know, this was not what I really wanted. What I now say is, what a great adventure. When you trust the Lord, life is a marvelous adventure. God can take you places you would never dream, let you do things you would never believe possible. My parents even finally approved me being a Christian. When I became a seminary president, they finally decided I was legitimate, and it was okay. All right, time's up. Thank you very much.